through the glen. Robin Hood, Robin Hood, with his band of men. Feared by the bad, loved by the good. Robin Hood, Robin Hood, Robin Hood.
For millions of viewers, the opening theme of the 1950s TV series, The Adventures of Robin Hood, summed up the latter-day legend of the hero who stole from the rich and gave to the poor. That's the image of Robin Hood that comes out in this year's Russell Crowe movie and runs back through the classic 1922 Douglas Fairbanks film, a 1908 film before that, and various kinds of entertainments going back to the 17th century. But if we go back even further in time, does Robin Hood remain the same? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
How far back does Robin Hood go? Where do all of those other characters come in? Little John, Friar Tuck, Maid Marian, and the Sheriff of Nottingham. And what evidence do we have that Robin Hood existed in the first place? Well, our guest has been looking for Robin Hood from an unlikely perspective. She's Tina Chancey, an early music scholar and the director of the early music ensemble Hesperus, and she went looking for Robin Hood, the man and the legend, and turned up some surprises.
Oh, welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Before we talk about the musical aspect of Robin Hood, let's talk about Robin Hood himself. What's myth and what's fact?
Oh, well, if you have to look for facts, I think you're going to be in trouble. When I was trying to figure out what to say, you know, I looked up all sorts of things like story and myth and legend, and they all pointed out that the subject had to be very interesting, you know, charismatic, but he didn't really have to be real. And I think that's smart, because it's awfully hard to tell where the real Robin Hood was, if there was one. The only person that we have who might be the model for Robin Hood was a thief called Robert Hood, who was prosecuted in, I think, the year 1261. But frankly, there's not enough about someone named Robin Hood to make us feel that he really lived. We think that maybe the person was an amalgamation of all sorts of different thieves who also, there were maybe legends about them and things grew up that they were tales. And there became a person who, originally speaking, was a yeoman, not a noble, and was just a kind of trickster like Till Eulenspiegel. So he wasn't somebody who was at all virtuous. He was kind of silly, kind of a buffoon.
English origin, though?
Yes, English origin. And what happened was the character of Robin Hood changed as the societies changed. Through the 14th century and into the 15th and 16th century, Robin Hood became a nobleman. And then he became very high principled. And he robbed from the rich and give to the poor. He became a patriot. He acquired Maid Marian and Friar Tuck and the other guys along the way. And he became the person now that we celebrate as, you know, one of the original Superman-type characters. But in the beginning, he was just a thief.
What are some of the early references that you find to Robin Hood and where?
Well, the earliest references that were written were around 1450. There were a bunch of plays and ballads that were actually written down and printed. They think the earliest was 1450, the next was something like 1503. And by the middle of the 1500s, there were a whole lot of stories about Robin Hood, but they were all pretty different. I think that's because the stories were taken from different periods in the thief's evolution. So some of the stories have him being pretty silly and basic, and some of them have him being very, you know, wise and, you know, just a wonderful person, like a really, really great Boy Scout.
What do you mean by silly?
He'll bop someone in the head and kiss his wife and go off with the family jewels, you know. It's really very much of a trickster.
But not the noble idea of taking from the rich and giving to the poor.
No, and all by himself. So the original tales were really of a single guy. He didn't have a whole retinue. He wasn't dressed in green, and he didn't live in Sherwood Forest.
Well, you mentioned Till Eulenspiegel, probably most famous, at least to many of us, in the form of that Richard Strauss tone poem, which details the adventures,
right.
Again, the trickster life of Till Eulenspiegel, very shallow kind of character. So you're saying that early Robin Hood really is in that tradition.
Exactly. Or I would compare him to the Mullah Nasruddin, who was another type of trickster, maybe a deeper trickster in the Middle East, in the Middle Ages as well. And he was somebody who was silly but wise at the same time. But Robin Hood wasn't too wise, the earlier stories.
I noticed on your website, and we'll put a link to that on our website, the Hesperus website, you had for the Robin Hood Project some illustrations to show how even the way he's depicted in art changes over time. Can you say something about that? I know it's hard to do on radio, but he doesn't look anything like the same Robin Hood as pictures develop.
No, not at all. Some of the earliest etchings have him dressed like a yeoman. And a yeoman was an interesting person in feudal society. He wasn't a serf, and he wasn't a noble. He was independent. He was his own master, but he didn't have land. So many yeomen were archers or fighters, and other ones were just used as messengers, or they would supervise the household. So a yeoman was basically an independent person who wasn't really involved in the feudal system.
Really kind of a prototype of a middle class.
Yes and no, that most of the middle class offered some type of service or maybe some material thing. So he wasn't an artisan, and he wasn't a craftsman.
More of a farmer?
He was just
he didn't have land. No, what he was an independent agent. And he would do whatever needed to be done. Sometimes they hired out as mercenaries. Sometimes he would be a messenger. They were trustworthy because they were independent. And he would be hired to a feudal household. You know, he would be not somebody that would belong to it, but he would be hired by them for money.
I suspect there was a little poaching in the background, too, somehow.
Oh, probably so. My view of the yeoman, I keep thinking like, you know, Sam Spade or one of the detectives who basically, he's an independent agent who's depended on to be somewhat distant from events so he can be used in any capacity without thinking that he's prejudiced in some way or other.
Why do you think Robin Hood turned into a nobleman over time?
That was mostly the result of Henry VIII, because Henry VIII was a real Robin Hood fan. He loved the whole idea of hunting and shooting and being in the greenwood and living. I mean, it's a whole...
Fighting the establishment, though? I mean, was Robin Hood fighting the sheriff of Nottingham by the time Henry VIII comes along?
Not yet. But the interesting thing about Henry VIII was that even though he was the establishment, there were certain times of year that it was fun to go against the establishment, to overturn the establishment. One time was the Feast of Fools in January. And there were other occasions when the jester sat on the throne. There were other occasions where the jester sat on the throne and the king pretended to take orders from him. And Henry liked that kind of turnaround, if it was only temporary. So one of the pieces of lore from the past we have is when Henry VIII and his wife, we don't know which wife, were taking the air, and someone, so-called Robin Hood, came up with 200 archers, showed him an archery demonstration, and then took him off to the woods where there was a bower, and they had a feast on the king's deer. So Henry VIII enjoyed that type of play, and he really liked the conceit of the noble peasant. I mean, doesn't that sound like Marie Antoinette?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
But the man from the greenwood, who, however, was a cultured noble. And much music in his court was written about that little conceit. And that was flourishing at the same time as the May Day celebrations in both France and England. And it turns out that Robin and Marion were coupled in the May Day celebrations. I think it was because the Jeu de Robin et Marion, which was Adam de la Halle, in 1283, he wrote this nice story about Robin and Marion. That's the first time that they were together in print. And that got borrowed for the May Day celebrations. And I think our Robin Hood ended up with a girlfriend because of it.
Did we start getting songs then about at this time about Robin and Marion and
Absolutely.
Other things?
As well as things like Robin is to the greenwood gone. As a matter of fact, Hesperus has a lovely piece called Bonnie Sweet Robin. And it's an instrumental piece based on the tune My Robin is to the Greenwood Gone. Why don't we listen to that?
Thank you.
Bonnie Sweet Robin, based on My Robin Is to the Greenwood Gone. It sounds a little bit dolorous there at first, but that was almost kind of an Elizabethan, and maybe before that a motif of the reign of Henry.
Yes. Well, you know, to be cool in any society is a really particular combination of qualities. You know, when you have James Dean or somebody, you had your white T-shirt and your leather jacket, and that expression of being misunderstood. Or in Elizabethan society with Dowland, and this is actually from that period, it was really to be melancholy.
In sooth, mm-hmm. I know not why I am so sad.
Yeah. Yes, yes. I mean, it was a life position, right? And were they really melancholy? Yeah, probably not. But that was the affect, as well as, you know, to be in love with a queen who could not be in love with you because she was a virgin queen, which made it very safe. You know, it was a little like courtly love. In courtly love, you have to love somebody, but you can't tell her that you love her because she might love you back, and that's not allowed. And so you pine. And because you pine, you write songs and poems about how wonderful she is and how she doesn't know you're alive. But actually, that's how they used to keep the knights in check. Because if they didn't, the knights would get drunk and overrun the town. So they kept them at home writing poems and stories and things. So it's a life position.
But it's such beautiful music. Can you say something about the instrumentation? Because you've got instruments that are different than our modern instruments being mm-hmm. used here.
Yes, it's true. In this particular piece, it sounds like a violin, but it's not. The bowed strings were both members of the viola da gamba family. And the viola da gamba was actually a kind of a bowed guitar. It had six strings. It had frets. Actually, why am I saying it in the past? I play it now. It has six strings. It has frets. It comes in different sizes, like the violin family. The viola da gambas were invented 100 years before the violin family, and they were used in courts and chambers all over.
And how are they different in tone quality to a modern violin?
Well, you know, the viola da gamba is constructed, well, I could compare it more like a mirror, that the back of the viola da gamba is flat, and when the sound comes in, it's reflected. And in order to make it sound really good, the instrument has to be very loosely constructed, which means it's very resonant. So in a viola da gamba, it won't be necessarily very, very loud, but it'll be very sweet and resonant. On the other hand, if you look at the violin family, the back is rounded, and so the sound is collected something like a lens. And you know what a lens does? A lens can burn things. Basically, when you concentrate light like that, it really gives it power. And when you concentrate sound, the power shoots out louder. And so what you get then with a violin is you get a sound that's projected, but you have to sweeten it. And so a lot of violin players use vibrato, and that's one reason they do, because they're sweetening the sound. So you see, even though they look somewhat similar, the way they work is I compare it to the difference between a bicycle and a motorcycle. Right, they both have handlebars, they both have wheels, but the power is different. Still, it's just as much fun to ride a bicycle as a motorcycle, depending on what you want out of it.
And that gamba, doesn't that refer to holding it between the gams?
That's right. It's a fiddle of the gams. And all the different sizes of viola da gambas are held between the knees. These days, we use the bass, which is about like a cello, the tenor, which is about like a viola, and the treble, which is about like a violin. And also, in orchestras, we often use a double bass viola da gamba called a violone. And all of those have six strings and frets. And there's even, there are a few little ones around the side that are cute. For example, there's a par-dessus de viol, which is used in the Baroque period, which is really tiny. And it's kind of a hybrid mixture of violin and viola da gamba. It has five strings. It's tuned in fifths and fourths. Or you also have something like a baritone, which is viola da gamba with sympathetic strings that you would pluck with your thumb. Or a lirone, which is like a viola da gamba, but it has a very flat bridge, and it has what they call reentrant tuning, dum bum 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 bum, like that. And it's used basically for chordal accompaniment in late Renaissance and Baroque music.
And in the recording that we just heard, what were you playing?
I was playing the treble viol, or the treble viola da gamba. Mm-hmm. And my late husband, Scott Rice, was playing the alto recorder. And Jane Hershey was playing the bass viola da gamba, and Grant Herod was playing the lute.
Now, Henry VIII has compositions attributed to him. Did he play, too, do we know?
I bet he did, because it was the mark of a real courtier to be very good at dancing, very good at playing something. They were supposed to write at least poetry and hopefully music. And, of course, appreciate. A courtier was very appreciative of any of the arts.
And would there have been a song that went with what we heard as an instrumental setting?
You know, there was, but I'm afraid all I really know is the opening tune, which was played by the treble viol. My Robin is to the greenwood gone.
Just the place for Robin Hood?
That's true. That's where we're supposed to be.
Well, I want to find out about Robin Hood and King Richard the Lionhearted and Prince John, who always gets the bad rap in the story. We'll find out where all that came from in a moment when we return. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Tina Chancey, who is an early music scholar, one of the founders of Hesperus and its current director, and also, as we'll find out a little later in the hour, involved in a fascinating project having to do with Robin Hood and music. And meanwhile, we've been talking about this evolution of this person, this character, Robin Hood, and we've gotten him up to the time of Henry VIII, but somewhere in there, we have this legend about Robin Hood being a big fan, a supporter of Richard the Lionhearted, who's away on the Crusades, and in the meantime, his evil brother, Prince John, is running roughshod over the country. Where does that come in?
I wish I knew. The problem is that if we're trying to find the real Robin Hood, right, he's probably around at the time of King Edward, which is not one of those kings that
later.
We really, yeah, definitely a little later.
And which Edward? First, second, third?
Yeah,
that's a
question.
Lot of territory.
There's a lot of Edwards there. So these days, the Robin Hood that we know, the part of the legend that we're used to, is the Robin Hood that was around for King Richard and was threatened by Prince John. I have a feeling that we use that one because of that 1950s TV show. I think because, you know, when you have a legend and there are many pieces to it, you can choose any piece you want.
But now, let me think. If I remember correctly, all the way back to, you know, the last 24 hours in that 1922 Douglas Fairbanks film, mm-hmm. Prince John is the heavy and Richard is the one off of the Crusades and the guy everybody loves, even mm-hmm. though historically he was dumb enough to get himself imprisoned and ransomed. Mm-hmm. So somewhere along the line, earlier than 1922, at least.
Oh, that is true.
Whole thing
okay, that's
comes
true.
Up.
Well, you know what happened? The way the movie got worked out was that Douglas Fairbanks had been playing light romantic comedies. I saw one, and it was pretty dumb, actually. And I think he was looking for something else to do. And he was in the process of going to Europe, and so he said to his friend, Alan Dwan, who had directed him in one of his earlier films, he said, "Find me a story." So Alan Dwan found a story, and it was this particular version of Robin Hood, the one with Richard and John, and he probably commissioned it to be written. And Douglas Fairbanks said, "Oh, you know, sounds great. There's some stuff for me to do because I'm really athletic." And okay, let's do it. And they started building the set, and the set was a 900-foot castle, and they built it right where Santa Monica Boulevard is right now. So
real estate was a little cheaper in 1922.
So. And right behind it were a lot of fields, and so they could duplicate all sorts of things. In this particular story, you don't see Robin Hood for the first three quarters of the movie. Basically, what you see is his alter ego, who is the Earl of Huntingdon. And in this particular version of the story, the Earl of Huntingdon wins a joust, and so King Richard asks him to be his second in command as they go on the crusade. And once that happens, all sorts of things happen, you know, and somebody gets killed and somebody gets imprisoned and everybody's fine, it turns out. But he comes back secretly and he becomes Robin Hood. And that's the way the story goes.
I mean, that's very much, let's say, I'm trying to remember, I think he did The Mark of Zorro before that film. And it's
yes.
exactly the same idea as
it
this aristocrat is. Disguised as the avenging hero.
Mm-hmm. Though I'll tell you about The Mark of Zorro, the interesting thing about that, because that's one of my most recent projects, is we do a live soundtrack, well, a live score of Spanish Renaissance music that we improvise. For
would
the Mark
work,
of Zorro.
Would work well for
works
Spanish
very well.
California.
Yeah, that's right. And I did some research on Zorro. And it turns out that Zorro was created from the mind of the guy who wrote the curse of Capistrano. In 1919, there was nobody named Zorro before that. As a matter of fact, he wasn't even the title character in that story. Douglas Fairbanks saw that, and he optioned it. And the next year, he was Zorro. And reflecting the popularity of the movie, they changed the name of the story. So the story became, you know, the story of Zorro, and there were more and more stories, and that was the root of that legend.
So,
but there was no one particular person who was Zorro.
So Fairbanks really was paralleling that idea very closely.
Yeah.
And it, I mean, there's
well,
so
it did
many,
one for him already, yes.
Yeah.
So why not do
so
it again?
So many other characters coming afterward that do the same thing.
Yeah, and it's a fine way. I mean, if you're looking for some way of becoming an action hero, and he was the first action hero.
Doing his own stunts. Mm-hmm.
That's right. He did his own stunts. There was one place in the film where he slid down a very long curtain, and there was actually a playground slide behind that. And there were places that he jumped on trampolines so that he'd bounce, and other places where he crawled up the wall using handholds. And he loved that. Oh, he balanced on high precipices. And, you know, it was a wonderful thing for him, and he could do all his own stunts. I'm sure that he was insured for lots of money.
And you're talking about silent movies at this point, right?
That's right.
Can you tell us something about the special challenges of a silent movie and how music was used for them?
Yeah. We don't realize quite how a silent movie was made, but it had a script, and quite often there was music playing as the people were acting, as well as a director who had a big megaphone who was yelling, "Okay, a little to the right, now kiss her." You know, and so they were being directed as they played.
There was music playing in silent films?
A lot of people had in their contract that they wanted music playing as they acted because
even
they felt...
Even though the audience would never hear it.
Yes, they felt it gave a certain rhythm to their performance. And you know, that's really interesting because we find that in any type of film, there's a rhythm to each scene. But we find that people in silent films, they actually gesture in a way that's much more rhythmic than these days when people don't really do a lot of gesturing. One of my favorite gestures, at one point the outlaws come in and the nun says, "They're here," and her arm goes right up.
Yeah, what did that mean?
That was so wonderful. Yeah, she was gesturing. She was happy. And that type of gesture, if you didn't have music behind it, it would be a little silly, a little out of context, kind of Hollywood.
So that does raise an interesting question, though, as to how closely with music and what you have done with your ensemble is to provide music in the silent film tradition for every frame of a two-hour movie.
Oh, yeah.
The Robin Hood of 1922.
Mm-hmm.
How do you decide how close to match the music to the scene? And that doesn't even count the fact that you're playing Renaissance music, and there are obviously some limitations to the repertory.
Well, actually, Renaissance music is a very good style to use for this because unlike many styles of music, its sense of character and place and mood and things like that are really immediate. That when you hear the beginning of a Renaissance piece, you know pretty much it's going to end that way. And each one has a real flavor and taste to it. I mean, I was first drawn to Renaissance music when I was 12 years old, and my next-door neighbor had this really cool Christmas music that turned out to be Pretorius dances on recorders, and I thought, I want to play that. So that was so much for being 12. I didn't until I was 19. But it was really very striking. And so when I was trying to figure out what music to use for Robin Hood, I was going to use English medieval music, but it didn't have the same immediacy of mood. And the Henry VIII repertoire is definitely the right repertoire to use for this film. I think it really reflects the qualities in the acting as well, because Douglas Fairbanks made a very good-natured film. Good-natured, heroic. He was a happy hero, you know, and Marion was a sweetie, and Prince John was a real baddie, and King Richard was a good time guy, and Prince John was a baddie.
People actually hiss.
Oh, they
when
hiss.
They see
yes, last
Prince
night
John.
They hissed. And so it's a wonderful time, you know, when everything is so clear, especially when life is so messy. And so we liked reinforcing what was going on with Renaissance music because it's also, you know, it has that type of crystalline sense of mood that I think is very useful.
Say your project is to take this two-hour silent movie and to create a musical score for it.
Uh-huh.
How do you go about doing that? And how much of the music could be played just as is? How much did you have to sort of improvise and adjust?
I'm lucky in that I really know the Henry VIII repertoire. I've played a lot of it. So the first thing I did was I wrote down every piece I knew, and there were about 40 of them. And the next thing I did was I made a kind of a script or a timeline of what happened in the film. So I had basically a line for each event. You know, the king comes in, Prince John smirks, Marion comes. Each one would have a piece of music connected to it, or maybe there'd be one piece of music for the whole scene, something like that. And on the right-hand side, I would have the ongoing time, so I would know how long the scene was, what would elapse.
You'd have to tailor, let's say you had a two-minute Renaissance piece, but a scene that was a minute and a half.
Exactly. So you'd take something out or you'd put something in. And, for example, in the opening scene of Robin Hood, you see the good guy for a while, and then you see the bad guy for a while, and then you see the good guy. And there was music connected to the good guy and the bad guy. So we had to snip a little bit the good guy stuff so that it stopped just about when the bad guy comes in. And then we switch back and forth. One thing I had noticed is that if the music changes within 2 or 3 seconds of the change of scene, people are great with it. It doesn't have to be exact, which is good because there are some people who do silent films with a click track or with something. You'll have a conductor, and on his screen, he'll see the movie, and there will be a click track, and it'll say, start this here. I didn't have that. So each time we play it, if it's a little fast, it's a little slow, we have to adjust. I would rather do that. I think that it's a little over-organized to have the click track. I think you need it when you have an orchestra.
A little bit more spontaneous if
I'm
play
big on spontaneity.
A little bit more reacting to
the
moment.
Yeah. Is there another piece from Henry VIII's repertoire that we could listen to that shows kind of the type of piece you use in the movie?
Yes, let me play the piece that we use at the very end of the movie. Because the end of the movie, they've just been married and they're in a moonlit room.
Giving away the plot.
It's okay. They got married. And there they are and they're having a wonderful time. And all of a sudden, King Richard comes and knocks on the door. He wants to tell them something. And they totally ignore him. And the piece ends with him knocking on the door and stuff. But the music we play for this is just one of my favorite pieces ever. And it's called Philip Van Wilder's Dump. So let's listen to that. Well, that was Philip Van Wilder's Dump, and the person who played it was Grant Herod.
And Dump is spelled various ways, sometimes D-O-M-P-E, I think, is a type of piece that comes up a lot in the Renaissance.
That's right. It's an expression of melancholy. Remember that fashionable melancholy?
Down in the dumps?
Exactly. Or the doleful dumps, they would also say.
John Dowland wrote a lot of those.
He did. It was a type of dance. And this particular one has just two chords. Well, actually, that's not true. There's one place that it has a few, but then it goes back to a kind of an ostinato between two chords. So this particular piece has this ostinato between two chords, which I think is very effective. You can do a lot in music with chords that just simply go back and forth.
There's a purity to the Renaissance music somehow, just the instruments and the lines. It seems so kind of uncluttered.
I think so too, yeah.
Emotionally unambiguous.
Yes, or sometimes it's purposefully ambiguous, but it's pretty clear no matter what. Some of my favorite pieces in this time, they're talking about her, right? And the her is on the one hand, the girlfriend of the time, but it's also Queen Elizabeth, because Queen Elizabeth was everybody's girlfriend. And everybody had to pretend that they were in love with her and she didn't love them. As well as there are a few people that she
actually did
favor. Yes, right. And so the position, there was a lot of irony around. But even that irony was very well-bred, good-natured irony, you know, for can she excuse my wrongs? You know, that was written when somebody did something bad and she was unhappy and he wrote her a song saying, I'm sorry, honey, you know. I love you too much.
Was there dance scenes in the Douglas Fairbanks Robin Hood? Are there dance scenes where you would actually play dance music to? I'm trying to remember. There's some things that come awfully
music.
Close.
Yes, but actually we play dance music to the fight scenes.
Well, there are some of them are like ballet.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Those sword fights.
Fights were wonderful. Yeah, yeah. As a matter of fact, good sword fighting was loved in the Renaissance by all classes of society. So Robin had to be able to sword fight, though I understand from some people who have taught sword fighting that perhaps it wasn't the same type of sword fighting that they ended up developing for the 1920s. I think it was a little less dramatic, a little less flourishing, a little bit more...
To the point?
As it were. Thank you. That's good.
And what were the dances that you were playing actually meant to be used for? What kind of dances?
They were dances called brawls, which in English is B-R-A-W-L-E or in French is B-R-A-N-S-L-E. And brawls were those type of dances that had the rich people pretending to be poor. And so they were simple dances. Most often they were circle dances. And so you'd have people holding hands and going to the right and going to the left. And some of the dances were like the peas brawl. And the peas brawl, the first half you go right and left. And in the second half, you hop. One person hops, the second person hops, and then the first one hops three times. So, or one of the dances was the washerwoman's brawl, in which case the second part had one person scolding the other person.
It starts to sound like, I haven't done the etymology on it lately, but it starts to sound like the same general meaning as barroom brawl. I mean, there's
a lot of people
bumping around.
It was rich people acting like peasants. Uh-huh.
And would they have done it with costumes and masks and so on?
No, I think probably this type of dance was more as a social dance. It wasn't so complicated. But there were dances that were done with costumes, and those were a little bit later. Those were things like the Elizabethan mask. That's M-A-S-Q-U-E. And mask dances were very special. They were there, either the mask dances to provide something sweet and friendly, so the shepherds would dance or the nymphs would dance. But there was a type of mask dance called the anti-mask, and that was where the grotesques came out. So you'd have a satyr's mask or a witch's mask. Or in those masks, the people wore costumes, and they held very strange poses. So the music was written to support those. And as a matter of fact, let's hear one of those. Let's hear the satyr's mask. I believe it's my husband, Scott Rice, and myself on bass viol and Grant Herod.
Thank you.
the satyr's mask, one of those sort of anti-mask pieces, I guess you would say, the way that you described it, Tina. I'm wondering now what kind of variety, what sort of palette of music did you have for a two-hour film about Robin Hood?
Well, I was very lucky. I was working with some multi-instrumentalists. Tom Zajac plays not only recorders and Renaissance flute, but he plays sackbut, which is an early trombone, and he plays shawm, which is an early oboe. I know the people who play those would be horrified that I'm describing them that way, but we don't get a chance to really hear them specifically. He also plays something called a crimhorn, which we could hear, because in that piece that we started our second segment with, Blow Thy Horn, Hunter, I believe it was crimhorns, and I think there was a viol, viola da gamba, stuck in there. So crimhorns are what they call capped reeds. There's a reed in there, but you don't put your lips on it. Instead, there's a covering, and you blow into the covering.
And so you do this during the course of the film. I mean, because you're live. The film isn't going to stop for you.
Nope.
And so if you need to go from one instrument to the next, you have to have it right there. You pick it up.
Absolutely.
Go on to the next one.
And Grant Herod, who plays lute, also sings, and he also plays shawm in this version. What else does he? Oh, he plays something called pipe and tabor, which is a one-handed pipe. And most people who played that then suspended a drum from that arm, and so one hand would beat the drum and the other hand would play the one-handed pipe. It was the original one-man band.
I would think you guys could have quite the career doing Shakespeare plays.
Yes, it's true, though I find that somehow there's so much verbiage in Shakespeare plays that
people don't want
a lot of music. Yeah. Such a shame.
We're going to look at, was there any truth to the fact that there might have been a Robin Hood? When we continue in a moment with University of the Air. That's an excerpt from the silent film Robin Hood with music provided by the group Hesperus. And our guest is Tina Chancey, founding member and director of Hesperus and a musicologist. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. What do you think makes Robin Hood have such appeal over the years, over the generations? What is it about this figure that, regardless of how the story comes out, why is it that people keep loving that figure?
I think he's everybody's favorite action hero. I think that people all find something to love about him. He's like Boy Scout. I mean, he's generous. He's kind. He's nice to women. You know, he's good to kids. He robs from the rich and gives to the poor. You know, he's a superhero. He's not petty. He's, you know, strong and silent. You know, he's just somebody can find something they like. Everybody can find something they like.
Now, what are the other characters you think add to Robin Hood? Let's sort of go through them a little bit. For example, Marian, sometimes called Maid Marian, sometimes is shown as an aristocrat in the court who actually is kind of a mole. She kind of gives Robin Hood the lowdown on what the Sheriff of Nottingham is up to. That's a useful character.
It's a very useful character. And Friar Tuck is that anomaly who's a man of God who also fights, which is always kind of interesting. And then Robin Hood's faithful servant has become Little John, right? I don't quite know where Will Scarlet came in here. But do you realize that all of these folks were added after the year 1600, and you know, one thing I didn't answer that you asked me is Robin Hood, was he really a person? Was he really alive? And I've got to say that I don't think so, because every marker of a life that we have, you know, especially today and in the past too, every marker was absent when you think about Robin Hood.
The English kept pretty good records, didn't they?
They kept very good records.
So you're talking about birth records or anything like that?
Death, marriage, baptism, children. Baptism.
Arrests.
Arrests. Nobody sued him. He didn't sue anybody.
Robin,
he didn't buy property.
Could Robin Hood have been a pen name, though, for somebody else with a different name?
Oh, yes. It could have been an alias. But, you know, a lot of robbers in the 1300s called themselves Robin Hood because it was famous. You know, he was famous by then, and they wanted to be famous, too. So it's really hard to tell whether there was a real Robin Hood and who he was. And so I think that flexibility is one of the things that kept his legend alive. On the other hand, that's what makes it very hard to point to an exact person.
Now, also the Sheriff of Nottingham, I mean, which puts that whole twist on the thing, Robin Hood is working outside the law, and the law, by implication, is corrupt. Where does that come from?
Well, you know, back in the feudal period, and this is where the original Robin Hood got his start, it was very titillating to be an independent agent. That almost everybody at the time was either a serf or a noble or in some way involved in this hierarchy. As I was saying, the yeomen were some of the people who were independent, who were for hire, who weren't necessarily involved in the hierarchy, but just about everybody was. And the middle class was, you know, barely emerging. There were shopkeepers and stuff, but there were no pretensions to cultivation at that time. So the very idea of an outlaw who was justified in fighting against the law was really something very, you know, subversive and very tempting. And I think it is something like the idea of the Wild West. You had Billy the Kid and Jesse James, and these were people who were supposedly working for the good of the people, though, frankly, I think they were just, you know, robbing banks because they wanted money.
Yes.
Yeah, but we always try to have our outlaws be heroes, too.
So the noble outlaw.
Yeah.
So politically, then, was there any objection to Robin Hood? Because I would think there's kind of a built-in threat.
Had to be. There just had to be. I think that in literature, people reacted to him differently. One of the things that I found out, which I thought was very interesting, was that Shakespeare, who writes about just about everything, was really a politically conservative guy. And he parodied Robin Hood in Falstaff.
Sure,
yes. Yeah.
I mean, I think of him as more as a Friar Tuck kind of guy, but he is the braggart soldier and supposedly the superhero. But, of course, everything he does speaks against
right.
that.
And so that's his, you know, kind of take on Robin Hood. On the other hand, Bertolt Brecht used Robin Hood as the original model for Mackie Messer.
Sure. Well, and actually, and that goes back originally to that play, 1728.
Mm-hmm. The Beggar's Opera, indeed.
The Gay and Pepusch musical production, right? So mm-hmm. which would have been even closer to the source.
Mm-hmm. So I think that the model of the noble hero who was out to do good, I think it's been around certainly since Henry VIII.
What other projects do you have going? This idea of taking sort of a 20th century or 21st century work, a film, and then combining it with early music is pretty intriguing to pull those two worlds together.
Yeah.
Do you have other projects kind of in the horizon?
What I've been working lately on is making an actual DVD of the project that's closest to my heart right now, which is the music for The Mark of Zorro, which was Fairbanks' first swashbuckler.
I gather that the standard score wasn't always what people heard in a theater.
No, as a matter of fact, the score was written by a Hollywood composer for the premiere, but the score cost extra to rent. So when the movie started being rented and went around the country, a lot of places didn't rent the score. Instead, they used their local musicians who either were at a keyboard improvising, or they used that body of literature that was written for movies. And, you know, that was labeled chase music or love music or things like that. And I know a group in Colorado that uses that repertoire today to perform silent films.
It was sometimes even done with rather unreliable old platters, too, that you put on there. Ride of the Valkyries, if you needed something that was up-tempo, you know, and just the 18-year-old operator there making, what, 20 cents an hour would just kind of use his best judgment as to what to put on. So I gather it was quite a different experience.
Yeah. I mean, there were people who felt that there was an art to it. And a lot of books were published. I found one when I was a kid in the Cleveland Public Library, which was a book of music for silent film.
And so how are you going to take on the Mark of Zorro? You mentioned, what, Spanish Renaissance music?
Spanish Renaissance music. The thing about the Mark of Zorro was that it was written to be set in 1840, but Spain got out of Baja California in 1820, and it was really Mexican. On the other hand, Don Diego supposedly came from Spain. So there's a little bit mess there. So I made it a little bit earlier. I made it. And this music, it's improvised over repeating basses, repeating chord patterns like the folia and the romanesca and the caracosa and the jacara. These are all chord patterns which have a rich history of improvisation using guitars. And, you know, there are lots of vocal works written using the jacara model, and on top of their whole stories that are told using this jacara progression, or the folia, which is a big progression, especially in Baroque
music.
So this is all taken from Spanish Renaissance times, and they're wonderful to give the character of California.
You actually have an advantage over the organist. I mean, the standard score, I've heard it a couple of times, I guess, and it was always just a single organist. And you can do a certain amount with the stops of a theater organ to simulate instruments, but you've actually got the instruments.
Yes, and it's wonderful to be able to watch the screen and to respond at the same time. What we try to do is, on the one hand, we don't want to be too Mickey Mouse about it. We don't want to say, they're laughing, ha, 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 they're crying. So you want the music to have a sense of rhythm and, you know, continuousness. On the other hand, if there are trumpets, then Grant will pick up a cornetto and play some trumpets. And our singer, Nell Snedis, also plays Renaissance guitar. I forgot to mention her. And she lends really wonderful character to the vocals as well. And that gives us a really nice plucked section. So we can really reflect what happens on the stage.
So what do you do with all those great slides, though, that Douglas Fairbanks was famous for, you know, sliding 20 feet down a curtain?
Yeah.
How do you do that with Renaissance music?
You know, I think we ignore it.
So I have a devil's advocate question for you. What if someone says, why should I come to see, why should I watch a silent film with this music to it, because we're used to, you know, contemporary films that have words and color and everything. What is the appeal?
Yeah, that's a good question. Some people like to see what their grandparents saw. Some people enjoy thinking, well, what did they do in the past? They're interested in Victrolas. They're interested in early films. You know, and I think that's a very good reason to go see something. But they also tend to regard those as primitive and what we have now as advanced. And I don't know, I play early instruments, and I have trouble thinking of those as primitive and the modern strings as advanced. I think that they're all suitable to the society where they were invented and played for various reasons. You know, a violin band is a great thing, you know, a violin section in an orchestra, but you'd never use it for Renaissance music. It's just too powerful. It's like, you know, killing a gnat with a gun or something. So what you're looking for here is an experience of more like a baseball game. What's going to happen? How's that going to work out? Because it's basically a collaboration, just like any type of team sport. And you're trying to figure out how the team works and what are they going to do here? And look at that. And wow, listen to this. It's really more of a process rather than a final product. I think people will be interested in that.
One thing I noticed about silent films, too, which is almost hard to articulate, but it seems to me an unusually strong bond among members of the audience and the performers, organist or ensemble in your case, that you don't get in a more conventional contemporary film. There's a chemistry there that is sort of hard to describe, but it's a different dimension.
I think so too.
What you'd otherwise get.
People tell me that their favorite experience is when the music and the film almost becomes one. And they think that's, you know, I think that's important too. And live music, there's nothing like live music.
Our guest has been very live with us for this past hour. She's Tina Chancy, the director of the group Hesperus, and also obviously quite the advocate of silent films and this unusual coupling of early music with early films. And also, she's become something of an expert on Robin Hood along the way. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air. From the Emancipation Proclamation right down to the most mundane procedural, they are one of the most powerful instruments a president has, the executive order. We'll look at some notable recent examples next Sunday afternoon at 4 here on University of the Air on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.